My name is Kim, and I'm a detective sergeant in the Atlanta metro area and a gang investigator. And I love listening to the Gangland Wire podcast.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we have a special guest, a former and now retired police sergeant, Rene Reyes. Rene has worked in patrol. Of course, we all had to start out in patrol, but she's worked narcotics, and she worked in the intelligence unit for quite a while, and then she went back to narcotics, and then went back out in patrol as a sergeant and came back in the narcotics unit. So she has a lot of experience working undercover. Rene, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Gary. I really appreciate the offer to come in and talk.
All right. Well, you're going to enlighten we call our fans wiretappers.
I see.
You're going to enlighten our fans about what it's like to be a woman working narcotics in a big city, because it can be a dangerous occupation.
Yes, it can. It really could have been. I was pretty lucky.
Now, yeah, you were.
You started out in the force in what year was it?
I came on in 1985. And I just retired last December of 2017. I was on for 33 years and had a pretty good career moving around, worked in different assignments. You're talking about the undercover. I had actually, Gary, never thought about it until I was asked by a former friend of ours, Kathy Pierce, to come down and do this kind of work. And she did, and I did, and it was really interesting. Because I was back in a time like 1988, where everything was pretty open in Kansas City, and there was quite a bit of drug flow.
What was it that made you decide to become a police officer to begin with?
That's a good question. I always wondered that myself.
I
could have been a fashion model, but you chose police.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's a good one, Gary. I think I had a neighbor whose dad was a police officer. He was Sergeant Brennan.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so I had met him a few times, and then I don't know why, I just always stuck in my head police work. And I just kind of thought it sounded really interesting, and it was very constantly changing. And that's something that I really was interested in. I didn't want to be stuck at a desk for the rest of my life doing something boring.
It's the only job that you can work about 10 different things over your career and not have a spoiled resume.
Very true. Very true. I mean, you can really get a large amount of experience working for the police department, doing all kinds of, helicopter pilot, canine officer, undercover detective.
Computer, accountant. There's all kinds of stuff you can
do. Fraud investigator, fire investigator. You could do just about anything.
Yeah, but why would you want to go into something like narcotics?
Well, like I was saying, I had never really thought about it before until the sergeant I had she had gone to the undercover. She'd been undercover before, and I didn't know that. And she had taken over the undercover squad, and then she asked me to go, and she said she thought I had the skill set to be able to do that kind of work, because undercover work, it's a tricky little animal there for somebody to do undercover work, because you have to be calm, because you never know the kind of situations you're going into, and you have to be quick-witted, because sometimes people present questions to you or do things that will question your identity or your reason for being there, and you have to be able to have a quick response. You have to think quick, quick on your feet. And she said, I think you're capable of doing that. So, okay, I'll try it.
I guess there's only one way to find out. Yeah. How quick you are on your feet.
Exactly. You know, you're in those situations. If you don't come up with an answer or do something quick that solves a problem, you're going to be in trouble. So it was interesting. It was fun. You know, one thing I think I always used to compare it to was you see people acting in TV shows. Well, undercover, you're acting because you're not yourself. You're being a totally different person. So you can kind of take on a different persona. And that's what I did. You know, it wasn't me. It was somebody else. You know, you could do things. You could say stuff. You could act, you know, different than you really were.
That's kind of interesting. I never really worked exactly undercover, and especially in that narcotics kind of a arena, shall we say, where you really got up close and personal with people. Mm-hmm. You and I both, we use proper English. Well, many people in that world, that subculture, in the crime or the criminal subculture, they don't particularly use proper English. And they have maybe a kind of a strange sense of humor, and they're for want of a better term, a lot of them are booger eating morons, and so you know you got to fit in with a booger eating moron.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have to adapt to the situation, take on some of the characteristics that your people that you're dealing with at that time are like. And so, like I said, you had to be quick-witted. You just had to be quick on your feet, period, to kind of fit into your situation. That was one thing I think that I had a good skill with, because, you know, I got along with people really well. And I think being a female, a lot of times people were more accepting of a female in that situation. I wasn't as threatening as some of my male partners were. I could easily walk into some places that they couldn't. So it worked out really well for me a lot of times.
Most people, when it comes to selling drugs, they're not just like walking up to you saying, hey, you want to buy some drugs?
Well, actually, on some streets, yes. You walk down the street and people will walk right up to you. And you know, and some areas are known for drug selling, so people go there to score their dope. And so you walk down the street, people automatically think that's what you're there for. So they will approach you. A lot of the places that I did, I had specific targets that I was looking for. So I was the one usually approaching them and asking them the questions, trying to meet them to, you know, start a conversation, to get close enough to try to buy narcotics from them. So it just depended. But a lot of times you could just walk down a street and somebody would approach you, depending on the area you were in.
They wouldn't be guarded, like you thinking, you know, people coming up to them might be a...
You know, back when I did it, and I understand exactly what you're saying, but back when I did it, a lot of people were a lot less anxiety-ridden about it. They were a lot freer about it.
There hadn't been all these TV shows
exactly,
about it.
Exactly. There weren't. Yeah, exactly. When The Wire wasn't out.
The Wire. And they learned a lot from The Wire about police procedure, didn't they?
Oh, my God, yes. I was like, I would watch that show and go, oh, my God, they just told them everything. So that show really opened up a lot of people's eyes. But, yeah, it was before that, so a lot of people didn't have any idea how undercover officers worked. They weren't as knowledgeable about what they would look like, you know, how we would do stuff. So they were a lot more open to selling to
plus a lot of them any back then, those days especially, the narcotics sellers were looking for a guy that looked like me. That, you know, I had cop written all over my face.
True.
And you don't have cop written all over your face.
No,
so
Yeah, exactly. I was a female, and I looked just like any other gal walking down the street. And I purposely, you know, we tried to dress to fit in our areas, so we weren't dressed in business suits or dresses or anything like that. I was wearing jeans and a T-shirt and just be walking down the street like any other person and, you know, looking like or just looking like maybe I might approach people and say, use some of the slang that was around then. And
so what would have been some of that?
One of the things that they used to say back in the, and they kind of still say it, they go, anything happening? And so people would like, what are you looking for? And then you'd have to like green, white, powder, I'm trying to think, you know, like rock, stuff like that, hard, you know, it just depended on the area. And kind of when we went to different areas, we kind of have a good idea what they were selling there, so we knew what to ask for.
But a lot of times weren't those pretty small time just street hustlers, street dealers?
Some of those, especially in the street level, absolutely. They were street quantities for the most part. When I was trying to do bigger guys, those were the ones that we'd get either intelligence information on or we get complaints about them. And then we'd have to do like surveillance and see if what kind of traffic they had there and do some background, a lot of background on it to kind of build up a case depending on the type of target we were looking at. If it was a bigger subject or target that I was looking for, we'd have to try to usually approach them or try to get an informant that might know them and they could introduce us, because when I did undercover work, we did all of the deals person to person. We didn't use an undercover. I mean, we didn't use an informant. We did
You didn't
stuff.
Do a control buy. You
we
did,
didn't do control buys.
Control buy is when you send somebody else out
right.
with you the money. You pat them down. You give them the money. And sit them in and then watch them. And then when they come out,
right.
they take the dope.
Right. And give it to you. Yeah.
And document all that.
Yeah. And sometimes those people... Sometimes some targets required that because they just wouldn't meet anybody else. But then you'd probably try to have your informant wired, if at all possible, so that way you could document and an audio record the actual transaction. But sometimes, you know, hopefully, you know, I was lucky and I was able to almost always get in to meet the target that I wanted.
So,
and part of that was because you were a woman.
I think so. Yes, I think very much so. A lot of times, these people were not threatened by a female.
Plus, you have a knack of putting people at ease also.
I'd like to think that.
You do. So you remember your first buy? Was it pretty exciting?
Young girl,
yes, police officer
yes.
out there. And she makes her first buy. What do you remember about
I do
that?
Remember it. I was taken out with a couple of the other detectives that had been on a while during my training, and they just said, get in the back seat. And so I did, and we were driving around the city, and then we went to an area where we knew that they sold freely out in the streets. And so we went there, and they said, okay, your job today is to get a $20 rock. I'm like, okay. And they go, we're going to take you somewhere, and it's all on you. And I'm like, all right. So I go driving down the street, and they slow down, and I'm in the back seat, roll the window down, and these guys start walking up, and I'm like, just want to get a 20. And the guys are like, okay. And so they're just pulling stuff out of their pockets, and I'm looking at them, and I pick out one and kind of going back and forth and with the guy who was selling them, and I'm like, that's really tiny and la la la. And then the next thing you know, he's like, okay, well, how about this one? And I'm like, okay, that'll be good. And I give him a 20 and we drive off, and they're like, okay, you did pretty good. And I was like, score.
High fives all around.
Yeah, I was like, I did it. So it wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be, but you were
in the backseat of an undercover cop car.
Yes.
And nothing was really going to happen. They're probably like, good call on saying that first rock was kind of small.
Yeah, they were like, well, because some
that
people
was
like,
a good call.
Yeah. I was like, well, that was really tiny. It was really tiny.
How would you know?
Yeah, exactly. They're looking at me like, I'm like, well, I figured $20, I should be able to at least kind of see it. Yeah. But they were, you know, because they give us training and before we go out there. So I'd been through some training. I kind of knew what dope was. Looked like, and I'd helped tested it before and are tested on different search warrants that, you know, other people had done. So I knew what it was supposed to look like. I knew what it was supposed to feel like. So I wasn't like totally unprepared, but actually talking to somebody about it, that hadn't happened yet. So they were like, we're going to get you out there and we're going to get this done. And I'm like, okay. So we did it and it was no problem. And, you know, sometimes people try to rob you. It just depends. You know, you never know with these guys because these street vendors, you know, they just want to make some money.
Yeah, I mean, there have been incidents. Obviously, we've interviewed other people where they were involved in robbing from drug dealers.
Yeah.
So I don't see why it couldn't happen to you when you're trying to buy.
Oh, yeah. It happened before. I had undercovers that worked for me that got robbed.
It happened all the time.
Yeah.
I was going to say, did you ever end up scoring any oregano when you're like, wait a second.
Well, you know,
they're trying to sell me this isn't even real weed.
Exactly.
It was soap.
Soap was a big thing.
That's what they called the crack cocaine soap.
Yeah, and then sometimes people would do wax, a can of wax. That was a good one. I actually was very lucky, and I never bought any fake stuff. I was really lucky. Because, you know, like I said, I knew what it was supposed to be, look like, and feel like, but I didn't know what it was supposed to smell like. And some of the guys would tell me all the time after I'd been buying for a while, the undercovers would tell me that crack cocaine smells like dirt. And I was like, no, it doesn't. And they're like, yes, it does. Put your face in it. And I'm like, no. I said, I don't notice a smell. And they're like, oh, yeah, it smells like dirt. And I'm like, I never noticed it. But they were all, like, convinced.
Renee,
mm-hmm.
You know, go around and make these street dealers small. You make these small buys from street dealers, but then you want to work up, right?
Right, always.
And so what would be an example of working up from a street dealer that you remember that you were part of?
We were having a lot of problems with Jamaican individuals that were coming from New York down to the Kansas City area, opening up big drug trafficking operations at different houses. They would buy lots of houses because they had a lot of money, and they would use some as stash houses and then some as their houses that they'd have, like just crack houses where people would come in, buy their stuff, use, stay there, whatever. But we were trying to always get to the main dealers so that way we could stop the problem and try to work on the quality of life issues for the neighborhood that those houses were in. And so we tried to identify the major dealers, and that's what I was targeting when I was in the undercover unit.
So and we had David Starbuck. We had David Starbuck and we had David Barton on here talking about that Jamaican task force. That was quite an operation. Now, what your duties during that time were? What background intelligence? Were you going out to these rock houses and buying from Jamaicans?
I was getting the intel after it was already developed since I was undercover, and then I was like conducting surveillance, trying to build it up, so because I was going to be the one going into these places trying to buy dope and meet people. And so I would, like I said, do some surveillance, and then me and my partner would try to go up, and then I would try to knock on door, get in, buy some crack, get out, and then build up my weight as I went along. You know, every time I'd go back, you know, I didn't try to do like a million buys, but I tried to do several to try to build the amount of weight so that way I'd have a good case to present to the prosecutors. And the larger I got, larger amounts I did purchase, that would help push me up to closer to the dealer.
So, well, when you went in, did you go in the same house over and over again where they got to know who you were and remember you and that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely, because the more they got to see you, the more trusting they would be, and the closer I would get to the main dealer. That's what I was trying to do. And a lot of times you might have to deal with their flunkies at first because they didn't want to meet people. But the larger you go in amounts, they don't want to give the big money to their lackeys. They want to handle it themselves. So the more you can push for larger amounts, the more you get closer to the main dealer.
So this wasn't a matter of you were going in for a buy for like personal use. You were really going in for a buy because you were dealing.
Exactly.
That's at least what you were presenting to
them.
That's
what I was trying to say. Yeah, that's what I try to say. Like most of the time, especially being a female, they didn't think of a lot of women being dealers. So I was going in for my man to get dope so he could sell. And you know that he was being cautious, so that's why he would send me. And so, of course, all the main dealers were like, that's smart. You know, he's a good, you know, that sounds like a good guy. You know, send the woman. Send the woman.
Sounds like a good guy.
Yeah.
Let her take the chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone's going to get shot.
Yeah, it's going to be her, and then he'll be fine.
Wait, you didn't know? Go into these houses and there weren't guns on the tables?
Oh, yeah, there was guns on the tables. Absolutely. I mean, there'd be guns everywhere. I was just talking to Gary about this earlier, and I was like, you know, I was lucky throughout my career. I rarely got a weapon pulled on me. But I could tell you numerous times, my partner, he constantly would have guns pointed at him, stuck in his mouth. They'd lock the doors on him, you know, accusing him of being a cop and just putting him through the ringer. And that, I rarely had any problems. I really didn't have any problems. And matter of fact, I had the opposite. I mean, a lot of times the dealers would become more, they were more interested in me for romantic ideas and wanted to get close in that manner. And so I was always kind of having to come up with excuses, which always worked good that I was getting dope for my man.
Yeah, that would let him know there was a man out there somewhere.
Exactly.
Well, was that partner that would then show up later that they'd hassle or lock in the bathroom?
Yeah. Well, you know, most of the time I went in and my partner would stay in the car.
Did you ever introduce him in as
no.
your man? You always just
only
had this man out there somewhere.
They could look out the window.
A lot of times I just leave him out in the car, and that's how we just did things. He had to stay in the car just in case something would happen. But I can remember doing this this one family that was in the Northeast area, and I had to take an informant, and he would introduce me. This was a family, long-term criminal activity, involved in all kinds of criminal activity, drugs, burglaries, homicides, robberies.
Everybody at East Patrol knew him by name.
Exactly.
And all the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
This was a notorious crime family in Northeast.
Exactly.
I know where you're going with this. It's a good story.
Yeah.
Keep going.
And they had been trying to do him for a while, and they couldn't get the main son or brother of this family. I had this informant who said, I can introduce you to him. I can get you in there. And he goes, but they're going to make me stick around. And I was like, okay, when we get in there.
So you trusted this informant enough to introduce you in, yeah, just you by yourself into, yeah, this house full of criminals.
Right. We'd been using him a lot. And I'd been using him for a while. He'd been around for a long time. So he was pretty good. He's kind of goofy, but, you know, like they all are. But he was, I knew I could trust him with me. And so he brought me in. And I started meeting the family, and the main brother started coming around on some of the deals when I would show up. And I always kept the informant with me. I was dealing with one of the sisters. The sister, I found out later that she might have been bisexual, and she was always super friendly to me.
So she was interested in you also.
Yeah, but at first it was always business, but she was always, and then after a while I kept going there, because when I was originally buying from them, it was powder cocaine.
Yeah.
And powder cocaine, it takes a lot of weight to get up to federal levels. And so I had to do lots of buys with them. They became my buddies, man. They were like, hey, why don't you stay for dinner? And, you know, and they'd always have drinks ready for, you know, here's some beer, have a beer, relax. You know, it's going to be a while before the, you know, dope shows up, da 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 da. And I'm like, okay. So I might be in the house with this guy, her and some of her other, the rest of the family, for like hours. Waiting.
And what'd you talk about with them?
We just talk. They talk about the neighborhood. They talk about different people, and I would just talk about it with them. Yeah. And because I knew who they hung out with, so I would say, yeah. But I had, my story was that I was from out of town, had moved there with my man, and that I really didn't know a lot of people, and I just met this idiot at the park, you know, because they didn't really like him, and so and so they were always giving him a hard time, and you know, so anyway. It would just work out. And so I'd have to leave for a while just to let my surveillance crews know that everything was all right. Because back when I bought dope, we didn't have the best equipment. So they couldn't always hear you in a house, even though you might be monitored. So I'd leave for a while, go outside, get on a radio, police radio, let them all know, hey, I'm waiting on the dope. It's going to be a while. And so my surveillance crews would know not to do anything, come in and try to, you know, rescue me or anything like that. Then I go back in. I got to know the family so well that after a while, the brother that everybody wanted to get would come out and talk to me about dope, and he'd say, I'll get you whatever you need. So I started dealing with him. And then I can remember one time the dope was taking a long time. He's like, well, now, you know, their supplier couldn't come to the house. So he was like telling them to come pick it up. And the main guy, he didn't want to drive. And so his sister's like, well, I'll take you. I'll just take the car. And he's like, no, I don't trust you. He goes, let her drive. He goes, I like her. Let her drive. So I walk out of the house with his keys. I jump into his car, and I end up driving everybody over to KCK to go pick up a load of cocaine.
Oh, God.
And so my surveillance crews are like,
they're
seeing me come out.
They're going crazy because you couldn't tell them what you were doing.
I couldn't tell them, and I couldn't tell if they could hear me or not because I didn't know if my Kel was working properly, but I'm like coming out, walking slowly to the car, talking out loud. So, I can't believe your brother's letting me drive. And, you know, that's really, he goes, well, you know, he doesn't have a license. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just driving here.
Yeah. I'm just going to drive over to KCK.
I'm okay. I'm just driving over to wherever they want to go.
No, I think we're going. It's KCK. Are you guys near the address?
Is that where we're going? Yeah. I can hear you now.
Nobody ever was like, man, she's kind of a loud talker.
Yeah. Oh, no. Not if you met this family. I think everybody in this family was loud talkers. I mean, I was
like some of the best mic work you ever did. Yeah, just getting them to talk.
Yeah, exactly. And they talked. So yeah, that was one. That was a funny one. Everybody's like, I cannot believe in the history of undercover that the bad guy lets you borrow his car to go pick up his dope for him. And you know, I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Okay, I don't know.
So now you mentioned the term Kel was a Kel worker. And explain what a Kel is. A lot of people won't know what a Kel is. K-E-L.
Yes, K-E-L. And it's a piece of equipment that anybody who does undercover work would utilize to help monitor. It broadcasts your voice, any vocal transmissions that are around you or you, anybody's close to you, it broadcasts that transmission of whatever your conversation is to portable radios. And it also can record your conversations also. My Kel, I had two of them on all the time because one of them only lasted... The battery only lasted so long, and after it started to really wear out, the battery inside it would like get burning hot.
I heard those things that will burn your skin.
Burning hot.
If you put them up, against your skin, guys have gotten burnt really bad.
Oh, yeah. And I used to always have mine on my side.
Yeah.
Because usually people didn't really, when they frisk you, they wouldn't really pat you down too much on the side.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't anybody ever like just patting you down to make sure you didn't
sometimes,
have a weapon
yes,
or anything?
Yes. Yeah, I was lucky.
Or a wire?
But that didn't really happen very much.
That
every
was
once
an advantage
while.
Of being a woman, yeah. I got a feeling.
Yeah, yeah. She had the underwire.
Yeah, exactly. Because I would sometimes place my Kel like underneath my arm, like under my bra strap. Which was really worked out convenient because you know, most times guys didn't feel up that high, so it worked out kind of good. But that Kel battery would just turn into fire, and it would just start burning through. It could burn your skin, burn whatever underneath there. So you had to be really careful with it. So you put the Kel on, and then maybe I might have another one that is like another piece of equipment that you could have hanging on your pocket or something like that. And that also only lasted as long as a 9-volt battery. So depending on how much conversation you had, it could wear out on you quickly.
Depending on how long it took to get the dope the cocaine to show up.
Yeah, and so I was always hopeful. You know, you always try to start with a fresh battery, but you never knew if it was going to last the whole time. And also, depending on the area you're in, you never knew if the transmissions was hitting the repeater, so
right.
that it could get out to the different radios.
Yeah,
so
they may not hear anything. They might get in the wrong place, and they might not hear anything.
Yeah, exactly. And that happened numerous times to me, depending, especially when I was dealing with that family because of the location of their house.
They had a big stone house.
They had, a big brick house, and the area that it was in was kind of low in a valley, so it wouldn't hit the repeaters. And so people wouldn't know what I was doing for hours. I'd just be in there, and every once in a while, I'd pop my head out, kind of like, oh, I got to go to my car and get something out, and because I didn't have phone. You know, it was back in the day where you didn't really have carry around cell phones a lot, so.
You wouldn't just use their phone to make a call?
Every once in a while, I would say you might use their phone, call somebody, and say, hey, everything's fine, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or I'm going to be late, tell them I can't pick up my kids, something like that. And
Then you'd have to call back into the unit or something, and then they'd have to call back out on the radio and say, hey, we got a call, she's okay.
Exactly, because, you know, we had a line, like a free line at our office.
A hello line.
Yeah. And so sometimes when you had to and you didn't have any other options, you'd call that line and hope that somebody answered the phone.
Yes,
and so
they
could tell
them. They're afraid they might have to work.
Yeah, exactly. Back in the day, undercover work was so much more different because you didn't have so much excellent technology they do now.
Yeah, they didn't have caller ID, and they couldn't maybe their phone had one of those things so it could call the last number you dialed.
Yes, exactly. You know, I think like right before I left, they were getting caller ID. So, I mean, and some people had it, some people didn't. So
cell phones,
finally. Yeah, I mean, they had the big brick cell phones. You remember those things?
Oh, yeah. Started those back then.
And so you could tell the really good dope dealers had those brick phones.
So you brought back a bunch of dope from KCK.
Yes, I did, and was able to get several search warrants
to their house and then go get a search warrant later that
day? I went back to the house. They cut everything up. And
it's kind of hard just to let all that go.
Yeah, I was like, well, okay, you know, let me just get mine, and I'll see you guys later. And they're like, okay, fine. And, you know, because I got several offers, of course, like I said, to stay and, you know, and the smoke and stuff like that.
Yeah, they wouldn't want to do some blow with you?
Actually, like I said, I always said it was for my man. It wasn't for me. And they were like, okay. And they go, oh, you know, that was smart, you know. And I was like, you know, when I'm around doing business, I said, I don't do that stuff. And they're like, okay. And they're like, and that one guy there in that family, he was always, like I said, kind of smitten with me. So he never pushed anything. He was always very nice to me. Hmm. So I was lucky. I really was lucky. I think a lot of other people might have been pushed another way, but I was lucky with those guys. And they were just always like, really cool to me, and so so when the time came to do them, I think that they were not really happy.
they felt betrayed.
They felt betrayed by old me. And they're
wait,
like,
what, so then did you end
I've
up having
betrayed
to,
by a woman before, but not like that. I'm sorry, Aaron. Go ahead.
Did you have to then appear in court? I mean, you found where they were having you went over to KCK. You had an address there,
right?
You had
right.
their address.
Yeah, I ended up having to get ready for court, but. I think I only had to go to trial on one of them because everybody else pled guilty because I had so much evidence against all of them. You know, I had my audio transmissions. I had surveillance video going back and forth. So I had so much evidence.
You had all the dope you bought from hand to hand.
Hand to hand. You know, hand to hands back in the day, that was the biggest thing, is that you have a hand to hand with an undercover, you had the best evidence ever.
Yeah.
You know, there was just no refuting it. And so if you had, I had, I don't even know how many buys I had with them. I bet you at least 15. You know, that's unsurmountable, especially in federal court.
Yeah.
So I was lucky on that one. I mean, it was, you know, like I said, we did a lot of deals because they were a larger family and they wanted to get as many brothers and sisters involved in it as they possibly could. And I was lucky because they would all talk to me.
Oh. So these people in KCK, did you learn much more about them? Was that part of a bigger operation?
That was, yeah. Actually, those guys were from Mexico. And,
oh, really?
Yep.
So they were going right to the source.
They were going right to the source. And these guys were, I think we did the deal with FBI cooperation. And they ended up tracing the crack cocaine or the cocaine. And I can't remember what, I want to say Sinaloa.
One of the cartels.
Yeah, I think it was Sinaloa. And I think it was those guys that they traced it back to. And then the FBI continued the investigation after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it works. You know, we start out on a local small level and start building up and gathering that intelligence. And pretty soon it gets out of your jurisdiction. And,
right.
And, you know, you can't.
We can't,
you know,
go
Kent
any further.
City Police can't go any further. They can barely go to KCK.
Exactly, exactly. And I was like, maybe I get to go to California, or can I, or where do I get to go to follow them? They're like, no, you're not.
You're just the local buyer.
Yeah, yeah.
Guadalajara.
Guadalajara. Guadalajara. Can I go to Tijuana?
Tijuana. Okay.
Would you really want to?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying, working undercover.
Yeah.
You know, no, you don't
dangerous.
Want to work undercover.
No, no,
Tijuana,
no, there. No, no, no. Just a vacation.
You're thinking more of a vacation down in Cabo San Lucas.
Yeah, exactly.
You speak Spanish?
No.
No, she doesn't. No. I could have told you that.
Oh, here we go with the verbal attacks now, Jenkins. There we go.
I speak better Spanish than Rene
go.
Reyes does.
It's really not fair, Jenkins. That's not fair.
So anyhow, then you moved on from narcotics, and again, that's when you came to work for me in the intelligence unit.
Yes.
I don't remember why we took you in there. I guess I felt sorry for you.
Yeah, I think you did.
I remembered you from Metro Patrol when you're this little young, wide-eyed police woman, kind of hanging around the edges, wanting to play with the big boys, but you were a little bit too young and too green.
Yeah, I was. I think people thought, because that's when Gary Jenkins was a tax sergeant, and he was a big man on campus. So I was not interested in going to tech, but, you know, because I always thought, why do those guys think it's fun to lay underneath a tree in the middle of the night pointing a gun at a house for hours on end? I don't get it. I just don't follow that.
We did other stuff, too, you know.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Moving right along. So you came into the intelligence unit.
Yes. I remember why I came there. And I remember a conversation we had when I first got there.
Oh, yeah?
You don't remember that?
I don't remember.
I remember it because it made such an impression on
me. Well, good. It's a management style of Sergeant Gary Jenkins.
Yeah, you're going to go, I didn't say that. I was being told that I was going to go work for you in the intel unit, and I went back to talk to you, and you go, I didn't pick you. I was told I was getting you. It's not up to me. And I was like, wow. I see, this is going to work out good.
Just a little.
So he hasn't changed much.
For you to perform at your best.
At my best. He goes, yeah.
You got to earn your place here.
Exactly. I was like, whoa, okay. I was like, well, if you don't want me, well, it's not up to me anymore. I'm like, okay, Gary, I hope it works out.
Well, had there been a woman in the intelligence unit that you worked with before?
Yeah, there had.
Lenny was there.
Lenny was there. Lenny had been there for a while. And then before that was Rachel was there.
When
I was a detective in the unit, Rachel was the first woman that they brought into the unit.
Okay. But I was brought there specifically to do undercover work.
You were the first one we had that really we brought in to do undercover work. And that's why they said, there was never been anybody that just, because Lenny, she was okay, but she really
didn't
work undercover.
Yeah.
Didn't do undercover work, mainly.
She played the part of the husband in the car.
Because mainly we did, we, we ran surveillances, we wrote down license numbers, and we got informants. And in the undercover, and you might meet an informant in a bar or something, but we didn't really interact with the mob guys because it was impossible to do.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of change in management and wanted to be a little more aggressive, and narcotics was coming on strong. And we kind of saw a way, I think, to start moving somebody in and actually doing some undercover and making some cases. So there was always a lot of pressure on us to make cases, and we resisted that because we wanted to gather intelligence.
Right. So then they brought, that's why you were resistant to me. I see that. But then they had me doing crazy stuff all the time, and murder for hires, did a couple of those, a few of those.
We did, yeah.
And then I started working part of the mob and going in and meeting these guys. At the direction of Sergeant Jenkins.
That's kind of that's with a guy, you send a guy into a bar and it's just really difficult for him to operate and to become accepted in any manner, unless he has maybe an informant that introduces him in. We ended up doing that a little bit, but it's so hard to get anybody to do that.
Right.
You know, it's in working the Brown family. This isn't working the Bim family from Northeast.
Right, exactly.
This is working guys that are really sharp and hip, and so it's really difficult to do. And we learned pretty quickly that a woman can do it. And the first one I really remember was our friend Jackie Dale.
That's right. And, you know, you guys had good intel on him that he was kind of a flirt, kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
That he, you know, of course...
He was a mob bookie.
He was a mob.
He was probably one of the bigger non-Italian mob bookies in the city. He really had a lot of action going. Yeah. So go ahead, tell us about meeting up with Jackie Dale.
Well, I had gotten a lot of information, of course, from our detectives and then from the FBI about him and the kind of book he was running, and that everybody was advising me, like, where he was running book and how they wanted me to meet him. He hung out at certain bars, and they were like, you're going to go in, and your job today is to meet him and start talking to him and see if you can get him to let you bet, or if he'll show you, or just talk to him. And I'm like, okay, fine. So we knew that one of the bars that he went into, and I want to say it was... The Caddy Shack?
Could have been, yeah. Could have been the Caddy Shack.
And
I'm not sure.
I think it was,
the main one I remember was up north of the river, up off of Berry Road, and I can't remember the name. I think it's closed now. I don't remember the name of it. But
I think the first one I actually met him at, I want to say it was the Caddy Shack.
Could have been.
And then there was another place off of up north that, what was that one called? I can't remember now, but Caddyshack, went in there, and with my look, I kind of looked like I was from the area, and so I just went up to the bar and sat down, and he was always sitting at the bar. We knew he was always sitting at the bar because that's where people would approach him to bet with him, and so I just went and sat at the bar, and I looked okay, and I'd always kind of dressed nicer, especially when you're dealing with the Italians.
There you would want to dress a little nicer, than when you're over in
Northeast. it would draw their attention, you know, and so... So I was sitting over there, and I order a drink, and next thing you know, after a while, he keeps looking over, and and then he's like, hey, you know, or he'd say something, you know, like, hey, you new around here? You know, start some kind of conversation, and I'd be like, well, kind of, you know, I just don't come in here all that, you know, and then the next, you know, they start talking, and I'm like... So do you come here all night? Start a conversation with him, start talking, and I'd see people coming up betting with him. I'd been watching people come up and bet with him, and I just kept watching him, and then he'd keep talking, and he comes over, and next thing you know, he sends a drink down to me, and he goes, I noticed you're drinking alone. I said, yeah, just kind of relaxing. He's like, well, I'm drinking alone. I'm like, oh, that sounds like a problem, you know, and then he's like, well, we shouldn't drink alone. I said, all righty. He goes, come on down here, and he was an older guy. I was probably like 26, 27 maybe, something like that, and he was probably like 50s.
50, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was like, and you know, those guys, they like to buy chicks drinks, and so he's, you know, starts talking, and he's buying me drinks, and of course, he'd been drinking, so he was pretty easy to talk to, and I'm like, what are you doing with those papers, you know, and he's like, you don't know, and he goes, I just collect these. I'm like, oh, okay, and talk more, and you know, I'd say, yeah, we go, what are you writing on, and he'd always be like keeping notes on stuff. And what you know, he was writing down who was coming up to him, how much they were betting, and so I was like, what are you writing down? I go, you watching football? What's the deal? I go, yeah, and he's like, why? He goes, you watch football? I said, sometimes. Yeah, I like football. And he's like, oh, yeah, you ever bet on football? And I said, I have. You know, and we start the conversation. And he's like, oh, yeah. And so then he started to explain to me. The more, and I'd see, and so I'd, you know, I'd say, well, I'd be in there for a few hours. And I'm like, well, I got to go. And he's like, well, give me your number. And I'm like, why am I going to give you my number? He goes, so I can call you. I'm like, well, you'll catch me next time. So I'd leave because he's always there. And so I said, oh, are you going to be here next week? And he's like, yeah. He goes, well, I'll be here all week. And I'm like, all right. He goes, where do you live at? And so I'm like, oh, I live up north. And he was like, oh, okay. Where up north? Well, I'd never really tell him. So then I'd leave, come back like the next day or 2 days later. There he is. Start talking to him again. And then it just kept going on like that. And he explained to me how to bet. But he didn't want me to bet with him because he liked me. That's what he always said. I like you. So then the next thing you know, my boss over there is like, you need to get closer to him. And I'm like, well, how close are we talking?
Closer.
Yeah.
And closer than a drink.
Closer than a drink. He goes, you need to go somewhere with him. I'm like, what? And so...
leave and get in the car and go somewhere, it like really puts you in.
Yeah.
Wait a second. This is Gary Jenkins telling you should do this.
This is Gary Jenkins.
Yes.
And trusted. I trusted my senior supervisor over here.
You're talking to me now, aren't you?
What happened? What happened to all this? I just want to gather intelligence, not make a case.
Jinx was like, I want to make a case on this guy. He told me right up front, I need you to make a case on this guy. I'm like, all right. I go, you just tell me what you need. And he's like, okay. Because it's not like a dope deal. You know, it wasn't easy in and out. It was like, you got to keep talking. Every time I came out of there, I was like writing notes to myself saying everything that he talked about, who he talked about, where, his businesses, because we started talking about what he owned. And then that's how he got into the offer. He wanted me to come work for him. So when I came out of there one time, I told Jinx, I go, I got a job. And Jinx is like, what? And I go, I got to go for an interview. And he's like laughing at me. And I said, that's not funny, Jinx, because he owned a massage parlor. And Jinx
oh,
is,
yeah, down in Northmore, wasn't it?
Yeah. And he's like, but you got to come in for a pre-interview. And I'm like, oh, yeah? And he's like, yeah. I go, who's the interview with? He goes, me. And I'm like, oh, okay. And, you know, he would talk about, had hot tubs in there, and he's like, we're going to try out the hot tub. And I'm like, okay, Jackie, you know. I go, I'm in. I said, you can just hire me now. You know I'm going to be good. He goes, oh, I know you're going to be good. And I'm like, okay. And he goes, but you got to come before. And I'm like, okay. So I would tell Jinx, come back, Jinx, I go, he's pushing on the job. I go, what do you want me to do? And, of course, you know, Jinx was like,
get in the hot tub.
I wasn't that pushy.
No, Jinx was like, we can't have you getting in the hot tub. No. We can't have it. And I'm like, okay, well, he's not going to go with a neck rub. I'll tell you right now.
Renee.
How are you going to fit that Kel into your bathing suit?
Yeah, exactly. That's gonna. It's going to haywire in there, buddy. It's not going to be good. So we got pretty far.
Wait a second. Did you actually go in then for an interview?
No, that was going to be my interview. I had to interview in the hot tub. It was going to be up close and personal. So I went as far as I could, and then Jinx was like, well, we can't go back because he's going to, you know, he made it very, very clear that he wanted to have sex with me. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, well, you know, okay.
That's not an offense that you could bust him for.
No.
It would be offensive, but
it was offensive.
Bust him
for it. It was offensive to me, but it wasn't anything I could arrest him for. Because I used to tell Jinx all the time, I go, you know, I don't know how much more of the pawing I can take.
He wasn't the best looking guy in the world either.
No.
He was a little bit old for you.
He was old and he was fat and he was just like, I was not pretty. And I'm like, I don't know, Jinx. One of these times I may haul off and hit him when he grabs something.
Well, but so you're still trying to get him to let you put in a sports bet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He let me bet with him.
Yeah,
I'd already got him.
You bet.
Yeah,
with
I already
him,
bet with him.
We had that
because I had met with him so many times that he finally let me bet with him. I'd gotten that. I'd gotten a really good description of his bookmaking stuff. You know, I had a lot of stuff on him, and I had everything that they needed to get him. And the thing they just wanted to get in the massage parlor and see what he had going on there, how he had the girls, which we kind of knew how he was hiring women, and. And how much he was paying him, because he told me, he said, here's the deal, you know, you can work for me, I think. He said it was like a 60-40 deal.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was like, okay, which probably wouldn't have been really a 60-40 deal. But, and, you know, he was very upfront with me about everything.
What's that mean? You get 60%, you touch 60% of the customer, you get 40% of the money?
Yeah, that's exactly. You know, he goes, you touch 100% of them, and I get 60% of that. So I was like, oh, that's not really fair, Jackie.
He was bringing you the customers and had all the had the building and the massage table and everything. He had everything. He had all the overhead. You had no overhead.
Yeah, he even said, he goes, I provide all your outfits for you.
And your outfits. Like, oh, boy.
Good to know. Good to know. Good to know. Okay.
All the hand lotion you could use.
All the hand lotion, hot oil that you could ever want. We got it.
But why didn't why didn't they send in another undercover cop in to get a massage?
You know, I think they already had established that it was.
And they have a prostitution charge out of it. Yeah, I don't remember now. Probably
I think
had,
that
probably
they
had Vice send somebody down
there. Yeah, and it was Northmore.
Yeah, it wasn't even in our city was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, nah. And so, I mean, they already knew that it what. They were pretty sure what he had, and so he just confirmed.
I think we sent Myers in to get a massage. You
I
know?
Think you might have.
I think we did.
I think you're right. Now that I think about it,
and I think he went over the hill.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he was like, "What was I supposed to say?"
Or was that Bubba? Yeah. I don't know ever which.
What's, is that a police term over the hill?
That's a police term. Yeah, that's an old Vice term. You go over the hill.
Over the hill. He went over the hill
with the prostitute.
Yeah,
you can fill it in, Aaron. You can figure that one out.
I don't understand. It's in the kind of Kansas, Missouri. It's a very flat country.
There are some hills.
Well, and he went right over it. No one was paying attention.
But yeah, I think that they got everything they wanted, and then they brought him in, and he, which is always the goal of the intelligence unit.
What they wanted to do was turn him.
And
of
he
course,
did.
One of the mob guys, the Italian guys.
Yeah, and I think he ended up talking. Didn't he?
Did he turn? No, I don't think he did.
He didn't. Okay.
No, I don't think he did. I'm sure he didn't. Because later on, a few years later, he's the guy that had a whole little casino going. Hmm. Were you still down there then? I think you'd been promoted. I was gone by then. He had a up north the river, up on North Oak, and the underground, the bottom, lower level of a strip mall where you had to drive around back. It really, you couldn't even know it was there. He had rented a big office space and cleared it all out and had an actual casino going in there.
Did he really?
A bunch of card tables and a dice table and a roulette wheel and a
whole
nine yards in there.
I didn't know that.
And that parking lot starting about 10:30, 11 o'clock on Friday and Saturday night would just be filled with cars.
I did not know
and
that.
The word had got around and they ended up busting it. And, you know, I don't remember. He's dead. I know he's
died. Yeah, he died.
Since then.
Yeah, I saw that too.
I can't remember now if they made some kind of a state charge in Clay County against him for that.
I thought, because I could have swore that I know he told him some stuff.
He probably did.
Maybe to get a reduced sentence, but he ended up not.
He did a little deep throat stuff over the next few years. Probably did a little deep throat kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're probably right.
He never like came out and testified and went into witness protection or anything. I know that. He probably did. Now I'm thinking about it, I bet he did.
Because I remember I didn't have to go to court on him.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and there wasn't a court case in the end, so he must have, the FBI must have
used him for something.
Used him over the long haul.
Yeah.
They got a ton of guys out there like that that just give little tidbits here and there that are good stuff.
Yeah. So that was a good one. That was fun. We did that one. And then
I don't remember anything else particularly. Oh, the wiretap that we
wiretap,
did.
Wiretap, yeah.
That was a pretty good one. Renee and the other female
Cheryl
went with you. Cheryl. And then Bubba and Doug. You guys all started. It was not a happy foursome either.
No.
They did not get along well.
Yeah,
but
it was
they all
really
started going into this nightclub that was this guy was supposed to be dealing dope out of, and then he had a wiretap on it, and they ended up making a bunch of buys with cocaine buys from people who were hanging out in the club, and they were kind of connected to the owner.
Yes.
The Italian guy who owned it, he was kind of a periphery mob guy. They knew him pretty well.
Yeah.
And they had, but they seemed to have their own source of cocaine. I never did figure that one out. But you guys made buys.
Yeah, we made buys. And
that was the night that you went, tell them about going over to Gracie's at After Hours Club. You guys came in the next day. It's like, oh my God, you did what?
Yeah. Well, you know, we were like, well, we were invited. What are we supposed to say? You know, we got to go along with the crowd, but we were all together.
Yeah, all four of you are together. Yeah. So there was,
you know, it's
strength
like
in numbers.
Strength in numbers. You know, there's two of us here and two of us there. And we're going to give it a shot and go in and or go over there. And I can remember that there was a ton of people there.
This was just in a house.
Yeah, it was just in a house.
Neighborhood.
Yeah.
And over in KCK.
You
know, was just off the books, kind of an after-hour deal.
Yeah, like a, I forgot what they call them.
Like a juke joint.
Like a juke joint. Exactly. And, you know, there's people just partying in there, just drinking it up. you know, everybody's smoking a little dope, stuff like that, and, you know, just kind of hanging out. And
did they have a band or music going?
They had music going. I don't. It's not a band, but they had music going. And
they have food.
They had food. I remember, and they had tables in there. Yeah. And I remember we stayed there for several hours just talking to people. But it was, I mean, just getting our faces saw different by different people. We wanted people to see us. Because, you know, the only time they ever saw us, because sometimes they would question, how come the only time we ever see you is when you come in the bar?
Yeah, really.
And, you know, you only come on these nights. I'm like, well, because I'm working or whatever. Yeah. So it was like, this is an opportunity to hang out with people and still have surveillance and, you know, and at least have people say, well, they did show up on this and they were here for this. A lot of times when I was buying dope or where they were buying dope, you know, you have to, you know, especially in that kind of a setting, it was a lot of people who, they were the regulars all the time at that bar.
Yeah, same people. Know?
And so the same people all the time. And if they didn't see you and didn't see you there on a regular basis, then you were not accepted. And that was one of the reasons that it took us a while to get into that place to get start buying dope, because they didn't know who we were. They just didn't know us. And they're like, new people were dangerous.
Yeah. I don't think the guys would ever bought the dope. I think you and Cheryl probably started buying the dope.
Yeah.
Because that's where you got caught. It kind of got caught in the end. Tell us about that. That
was
kind of an interesting little story.
You know, Jinx,
where anything that can go wrong will go wrong.
I can't remember that as well as you can.
Oh, really?
I don't know if I blocked it out.
You probably blocked it out, so I'll tell it.
Okay.
So Renee's bought some dope from this gal, just a small amount for personal use, basically, because that's what you were buying from.
Right, yeah.
You really did not have time to start buying up and getting larger weight and working yourself on past them. So they're over at that house, or maybe, no, I think it was in the club. They're on the West 12th Street. I think it was in that club before you went over to Gracie's later. I think it was called Gracie's.
I think so.
Later at night. But so there's a woman, there's a married couple, actually, or there were a couple that were together, was selling this dope, and you were buying from the woman, and you guys both go in the woman's bathroom, and she gives you the dope, and then she says, well, let's snort some right here. And you like, I shoot up. You know, I shoot up. I'll go out in the car and shoot up. And right then she knew they were already suspicious because they didn't know anything about you.
Mm-hmm.
And everything just turned cold after that, I remember.
Oh,
they just
that's
wouldn't
right.
speak to you after that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are you going to do?
What can you do, really?
I mean, you called, like, you'd go back to the bar, like, you're going to be a regular hanging out again.
Yeah, they just wouldn't speak to him.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, no, I don't know.
Kind of answer you, you know, if you try to ask them questions, they just kind of like,
kind of just like ignore you or something like that.
Ignore you
and
give you a yes or no answer and turn away. So it just turned cold after that.
You know, because there's always going to be, especially as long as we were trying to get in there, there's always going to be at some point a test. You know, whether or not you're going to use or not, especially when you're buying dope. And I think in that, because it was always personal use, it was really small. It wasn't like, you know, I can't do it right now. We're there drinking. Well, why couldn't you? There's really no good excuse.
Yeah. See, in those other cases, when you're buying dope from dope houses and street dealers and stuff, I mean, they didn't really want to hang around with you and smoke dope or do anything with you there. More than likely, they just get your money and go on.
Get your money and get out, yeah.
But this was, you were socializing these people. So it's really difficult to socialize with people over the long haul. You were lucky with that family over Northeast.
Yeah.
You were real lucky with them that they let you hang out and not do dope in front of them.
Yeah, and most of the time I was lucky because they never had as much as I wanted, so they always had to order out more.
Yeah.
So, you know, because I'd go there and order a couple ounces, you know, they didn't really always have that much that late. So they'd like, well, hang on a little bit, it's coming in. Or sometimes I would get there so early that they hadn't gotten their delivery yet. So then you just wait, and you wait, and you wait.
That's got to be some of the hardest parts because, I mean, you have to really stay in character sitting here waiting for an hour, 2 hours, three hours.
Oh, yeah. You know, and it, like, I was lucky because, you know, a lot of these people, they're just normal people like everybody else, you know, and so you could talk about anything. Some undercovers are really good and they could talk. I used to always joke and say, some people can talk about toilet paper.
about nothing
for nothing, you know? And so I would just be amazed. And so, you know, luckily, a lot of people you can talk about like nothing. What's the weather like? What have you been doing? How's your brother? How's this? How's that? You know? And then they'd start talking about something stupid. Because, you know, a lot of people, you know, dope dealers are not the smartest people in the world. Okay. And so they have problems. All of them have problems. So they'd start bitching about something and you just go on with that.
You could just like, well, just what about this or what about that?
Well, you know,
that's a big problem.
Yeah. You know, my brother did that, blah, blah, blah. And, you know,
tell me more.
Yeah, exactly. And you could just go on and on. And a lot of times, you know, they'd be drinking beer or something and they'd just start drinking and just
start
rambling
the same stories over and over
rambling
again.
and you wouldn't just care.
You wouldn't be like, I already heard that story. Tell me a new one.
No, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, all right, yeah. You know what? I don't know them.
What about your story though? I mean, didn't you have to have some kind of a story,
I had a story
and then keep it straight?
Yeah, and you know that's something that, like with mine, like we're doing that one family. The informant was supposed to be my boyfriend, and. Well, he's supposed to be my friend. He wasn't supposed to be necessarily my boyfriend, but my friend. And so whenever any of the guys were hitting on me or something like that, I'm like, oh, you know.
He'd be your friend.
Yeah. And then he was like, you know, well, he's here. And they're like, you're not really with him, are you? I'm like, well, not exactly. You know, I'm with somebody else, but, you know, he kind of likes me and everything. It's kind of embarrassing. And they're like, oh, okay. And, but a lot of other times, you know, I'd always say that, you know, I got to take this back for my man. You know, he's waiting for me, so I can't stay here forever. You know, I don't have an excuse, you know, and he might beat me up or, you know, he might whip my ass for this one.
In that world, that was reality, too.
Totally reality. Yeah. Total reality, you know, because a lot of times that's what they would do. That's exactly what they would do.
Yeah.
You know, if they sent their woman to go get something and she didn't come back and she didn't bring what they were supposed to bring in a certain amount of time, that's exactly what was going to happen. So there was, I never got questioned. Like I said, I was really lucky most of the time.
So moving along, you get promoted to sergeant. You go back to patrol.
Yep.
Then you come back into the narcotics unit.
And then I got asked to take over the undercover squad.
And you had the undercover squad.
Yes.
To take it over.
To take it over as supervisor.
So now you're sending people out.
Now I'm sending people out there. Yes. Yes, I am. And it was a different. You know, times had changed a lot.
Yeah, by then you had some modern equipment.
I had a lot more.
Cell phones.
Oh, yeah. Everything was a lot more.
Had a lot more help.
Help. A lot more help. A lot more safe than what we used to do back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be two people going out to one place and that'd be it, you know, most of the time.
Back then, yeah.
Back in the old days when I did it. And then when I came back and took over as supervisor, you'd have a whole squad that everybody would go out on the deal together. Whoever was doing the deal, you have your undercover, and then you have your surveillance squads, which might be three or four people. And you might have it videotaped and audiotaped, and they had excellent transmitters, you know, good kells that you could hear everything that was happening. You could hear a pin drop, you know, and back in my day, you wouldn't have any idea what's going on. So
this was like 2000s?
Yes, it was the 2000s, yes. And so we had, you know, they had a lot better equipment. I mean, every once in a while, yes, it would fail, but for the most part, it would work pretty good. And we had aerial surveillance. I mean, it was a lot better than when I came back as a supervisor. One of the biggest things was, for me, was cultivating good undercover officers. Because, you know, it's a specialized type of position.
You just can't throw anybody in there.
No. And there's a lot of people who absolutely do not want to do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely have no desire whatsoever. And some people are just inherently good at it. You know, I used to always say a good actor is a good liar.
Yeah.
You know, a good undercover is a good liar.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the key. You know, if you are good at lying, you'd be perfect as an undercover. That's why almost all informants and dope dealers are excellent liars.
Yeah.
You know, because they're used to deceiving people constantly. And I, you know, that was me too. I was, I felt like, I guess I earned that too, that I was good at lying to people.
But you never found yourself in a situation, I mean, you would leave a buy or, I mean, now you're running a crew.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be suspicious and maybe follow the person who is making the buy back to try to determine, are they really who they say they are? They live, you know, figure out where they live or anything like that.
You know, when I had the undercover squad, I had people that were questioned before. I had people, I had an undercover who they wanted to see her ID. They were questioning her on her address. And luckily, she had worked on where she lived at, because I think her actual ID showed like she lived in Sedalia.
Mm. That's smart. That's a good idea.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. And so she had gone. Because these were younger kids, you know, and then she'd gone to Google Maps and had looked at an aerial photograph of where that house was at, that location, so she'd have a description of what the house looked like in case anybody ever asked her. which was perfect because they're like, where'd you live at? You know, and she starts telling, well, and they go, where's that at? And so she started describing what the houses looked like in that area. And which was really weird was the guy lived, was originally from Sedalia.
Oh, man.
And he knew that street.
Oh, wow.
And so he was describing it. And so when she was describing it, he was like, when'd you live there? And she goes, oh, and she started telling him the years. And he was like, oh, okay. Well, you know, that supermarket's gone. And she was like, oh, really? And she goes, well, I haven't been back there in a while. And he goes, oh. And then, you know, he was totally cool with
it. That's cool.
But if she hadn't taken the time to go look at Google Maps and kind of get an idea of what that house looked like, what the street looked like, you know, he could have caught her easily. Yeah. And, but, you know, times have changed because people can do that. I mean, I had an undercover who somebody Googled his fake name, his crow name. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is in Google, everything. So all the court cases that he had done started popping up on Google, on federal cases.
Under
his fake name, the name that he had used.
So then they...
So they started looking for...
Had that in the transcript somehow in the court case.
Yeah, oh, and wow. So it started popping up. And so guy started printing off all the stuff. And then he put it on Facebook for this undercover. He put copies of some affidavits identifying his name. And then he also ran the detective's name and in Google. And then he went to... I take that back. It was a girl who did it. And then she ran him in all the local databases, like
CaseNet,
everything. Yeah.
He'd never gotten a divorce, so that would pop up in there. And that
got his addresses.
Yeah.
Got his address. Got his wife's name. How many kids he had? All the stuff. And she started putting all this stuff on Facebook.
Yeah, for about $30. Yeah, there's these websites out there that
are you talking about?
All that. Their Social Security number too.
That what they got was his fake name. And then there was a bunch of information on that, or they got his actual name as a detective?
They got his actual... At first, they got his fake name, but through the affidavits, they were able to identify, because they were able to identify him off the fake name. They put his picture. They ran his name, his fake name, on Google, and they'll pull up all the pictures on Google, whatever.
On the images, yeah.
Well, you guys should have done that too beforehand, right?
Right. Well, we should have thought of that. Yeah, then we started doing all this stuff.
About that after
that. Because at the time we were like, oh no. Well, you can do the facial scanner. Yeah. And so they pulled up all the pictures of people that looked like him, and it went to a Facebook, because he had a Facebook page. It pulled up the Facebook page, and it was him.
Oh, man.
The actual detective.
The actual detective. And so then they were like, oh, he's not who he says he is.
And then they put it up on Facebook themselves.
And she
put it,
yeah.
And
so
they tell her their dope friends, watch out for this
exactly.
guy.
They start saying, don't deal with so-and-so because he's an undercover cop,
well,
blah, blah, blah.
That's better than setting him up to kill him or something.
Right.
Well, I think some people, there were some threats on him.
Yeah, I bet there was.
And so he was like trying to go, and it was really bad because he, you know, they identified his wife.
Yeah,
and
that would
so
be bad.
He was trying to go through to try and delete. Because I think his wife had put a bunch of stuff on when they got married.
Yeah.
And so it had her full maiden name on there and her family and all this sort of stuff. So he was trying to go through Google to get all this stuff deleted. And they were like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Today's technology is amazing on both sides.
Yeah, you know? It is.
We don't find a lot of police officers wanting to have their photo taken.
No.
I noticed a lot of cops don't have a Facebook page.
You know, they used to, but... a lot of them did before, but now with the current, our department policy, it's become so restricted because, you know, you cannot, per policy, you cannot put anything on there that identifies you really as a police officer, and that would be considered derogatory or in any way cast, you know, anything against the police department. So a lot of guys have just said, forget it, because they don't want people, citizens trying to find them.
Yeah.
So they just deleted their Facebook, a lot of them. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
And now Facebook's for old people, so it doesn't matter.
Like me. Yeah, grandpa's
me.
Grandpa's to put pictures of their grandkids on there.
Now they just want to figure out which way you're going to vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That too.
Yeah.
You can usually figure that one out.
So you're back, you're sergeant, you're running the narcotics squad.
Yes.
And that was for a number of years, and then you left there and went on to just patrol?
No, then I took over our administrative squad and I did the undercover squad for about 6 years, and then I went to the administrative squad, and that squad handled search warrants, handled field possessions from the district officers, and they arrest somebody for a possession of narcotics, their cases would come to us, and then we'd do the interviews and then present the cases to whatever applicable county prosecutor. And so I handled that squad for another 6 years. And
then try to develop informants out of those guys that got cases on them.
A lot of people who got arrested for possession, we tried to develop them for informants so that way the undercovers could have more informants to work with. And we could identify more targets, good targets. And because we got a lot of intel by interviewing a lot of those people.
Yeah, really.
And so I had that squad for about 6 years, and then I went and took over as operations sergeant for our street narcotics unit and did that for about 5 years.
Wow, I didn't know you did that long.
Yeah, I think so, about 5 years.
Street narcotics. Yeah. Would you just handle all the equipment and cars? Yeah. And
drive
cars,
the van.
All the administrative details.
Yeah, all administrative stuff, and then I would handle the money and stuff that. Yeah, and so.
So when someone made a buy, they would come back to you and say, I need this much money for the buy. And you'd give them out, you'd allocate them out an amount of money.
Exactly.
And then they would come back and go, well, I got this rock for the money. And you'd go, well, it's kind of small.
Yeah, that's kind of small. They'd have to actually go to their supervisor first, and then they'd come back to me with a card and say, I spent $100 for this little teeny tiny piece. And then I would mock them.
Wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't you be, this seems a little questionable.
I would say, really? Or, you know, when you have guys that are brand new and they go and buy sheetrock and they paid, you know, $50 for this bag of sheetrock. And you look at them and you're like, it's always embarrassing, almost always on your first buy. So, yeah. So I did that for a while, and then I went back to the field right before I got promoted, and I kind of wanted just to go back to the roots.
That's where I ended up, at the roots.
Yeah, and just finished my career there, and it was really good.
You should have gone back to Metro where you started. I went back to CPD where I started.
Really? Well, you know, it's a different time now.
Different time now. You wanted to go out to the cushy station up north of the river, out of the suburbs.
I did. I went back up north and, or I should say went up north, and it was still, you know, it's all the same, you know, the same kind of calls. But I talked to you about this before, Gary, that today's society is so much more dependent on pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceuticals,
You know, that was something we talked about before when I had the admin squad. We saw fraud scripts going up like crazy, and everybody misusing their prescriptions, and you know, and falsifying prescriptions. You know, that was one of the things that I really got into when I had the admin squad, and being out in the field. You know, everybody is diagnosed with some type of mental illness, and it's sad to see, but a lot of them don't get the care that they need, don't get the medication that they need, or they go off their medication because they just don't want to do it anymore. And we have so many problems with people who have mental illness, and it causes a lot of police response, and those calls are like very involved. And thank God the department's been going to a lot more training. You know, they've been getting a lot more of the CIT officers who are especially trained to deal with individuals who have mental illness, which is wonderful.
Is that like crisis intervention something?
It's a crisis intervention team, but those officers are specially trained to deal with.
Yeah.
But all the officers, you know, have to deal with them, even if the CIT officers are not involved or not available. You have to deal with them on a day. I mean, I went back to the field, and I hadn't been trained gone to that specific training, but I had to, you know, I had to handle those calls all the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, we used to do it without the training before, you know, we just did it. But now these guys have a lot more resources. They have a lot more training in it. And so it's a little easier. You know, they know exactly what kind of questions to ask, how to deal with a lot of people who have mental illness. And it's really sad, but it's really prevalent without throughout Kansas City.
Mm. Yeah, they even have social workers assigned each station now, I noticed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a new deal. Yeah, it's a different deal.
It is, yeah. It's different this day. But most of the calls, though, are really the same, almost always, you know, domestic violence, disturbance, you know, and people still breaking the houses and breaking the cars. And every once in a while you have a shooting, so there's a lot of shootings, I should say. But
a lot of them, that's for sure.
Yeah, so.
As you seem that a lot more prevalent now that people go right to shooting versus back in when you first started?
Yeah, we had a lot more assaults I mean, we still have a lot of assaults, but a lot of them are weapon-based. You know, a lot of them are gun-related. We have so much more, so many more shootings and fatal shootings because people are so quick to respond to any offensive contact they have with anybody. Instead of trying to just talk about it or just like maybe a physical contact, it's immediate, you know, I'm going to kill you, you know, and then they just, and they don't care who's involved or who might be in their area. You know, you hear about these poor kids that are getting shot in the bedrooms. You know, that used to happen there for a while. We had lots of drive-by shootings, and it kind of dropped off, and it's back again. We had a lot of gang shootings for a long time. Gangs, per se, are out there. But they're not as cohesive as people used to, or people think they are. They're really, really wide-ranging, and, you know, some people will go from gang to gang, and it's not really limited to a specific area anymore. But these guys, most of it is all drug-centered. You know, people work somebody else's drug area, drug turf, and, you know, that's my area, and then the shooting starts. You know, you don't control this, blah, blah, blah. And it's back and forth, or it's a bad dope deal. Somebody shoots somebody, and then just constant retaliation. You'll see it going back and forth, back and forth. And you know, people just don't hesitate anymore to try to end something with a gun, and it never ends it. You know, just, you know, you shot him, now I'm going to shoot you, and I'm going to shoot him, and I'm going to shoot this your sister, and blah, blah, blah. Just goes on and on.
It is. It's a bad deal. It's from the time I was on, when I first came on, if you found a gun, it was like an old owl head or an old 25 automatic that probably would fall apart if you ever actually pulled the trigger. A few of them were halfway decent, or an old shotgun somebody cut off. But when I went into intelligence all those years, and I came back out, like, oh my God, by the 90s or late 80s, there was just all these really good guns. And I go back in, and I come back out a few years later in like the later middle 90s, 94, saying that was just before I retired. As all of a sudden, I mean, there was all these great guns out there, and guys knew what to do at a homicide scene. We, you know, when I first came on, we didn't know what to do. You just kind of bumbled your way through. And I came out as a sergeant, my first homicide scene. Guys are already there. They're already putting up yellow tape. They're telling me, okay, Sarge, we do this, we do this, we do this. I've notified this person. I've notified that person. I'm going, oh, man.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here, dude. We didn't have this kind of stuff last time I was out
exactly.
in patrol, because just didn't have it. You know, if you had a homicide, it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Mm-hmm. Just such a matter of course.
Right. Everybody knows exactly. You didn't tell the guy, I didn't pick you.
No, I was glad he was there.
Yeah.
You just keep doing a good job.
Yeah. Just tell me where I'm supposed to be standing.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and Renee, you said you worked with Officer Starbuck, who we'd interviewed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I worked
David
with
Starbuck.
Mm-hmm. He was my administrative guy when I was undercover. And so he was the one who would, like, bring me targets. It's like, hey, here you go, Renee. We got one for you. I want you to work on this guy. He's going here. He does this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, fine. Because he did a lot of the interviews of the informants and develop them for us to use. Or he'd do in custody interview with somebody, and they might talk about who they were getting their dope from, and he developed really good information about a dealer, and he's like, okay, we're going to work on this guy. I'm giving this guy to you. And so Starbuck, yeah, he was one of the ones who actually pushed me towards some of the Jamaicans in the beginning, because he wanted to get into them. And so that's how I ended up doing them.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you've had a great career. I really appreciate you being here and sharing all this with the folks out there. And
well, thank you, Gary, for inviting me.
It's very insightful.
Very insightful.
Hmm.
I tell you one quick story. We had David Martin in here. I never thought I'd ever hear anybody like this say this. We talked about, you know, all the narcotics work he'd done. Of course, you know, he was Mr. Narcotics in the police department. Rose all the way up to the commander of the unit from a detective in the unit.
Yep.
And stayed with it his whole career, and then worked it after he left.
Yeah,
he
that's just a long
high
time.
Intensity drug task force was over all the narcotics in the Midwest that wasn't, you know, like a had liaisoned with all the narcotics units in the state and state patrol, the state agencies and the local agencies. And he said, you know, we talked about the war on drugs. I was kidding about how we were once soldiers in Ronald Reagan's war on drugs. And he said, yeah, he said, and we lost that war, man. He said, this is a medical problem. We need to look at this differently. I thought, dang.
You know, and he's absolutely,
yeah, really.
Sadly, but he's absolutely right.
He is.
You know?
He is. It's just making passing laws and throwing police at it has not made any difference at all, really.
No.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, yeah. And harsher sentences, is that really?
Harsher sentences hadn't done any good either. God, I remember you give somebody that kingpin law, give them 50 years in jail, that'll make a snitch out of anybody.
Yeah.
And a lot of them would just snitch your way out.
Yeah.
So then you take down a bigger guy, and I don't know. It's just crazy.
You know, and it's always going to be, demand is never going to go away.
Right.
So it's constantly going to be there.
Because the demand, that's the medical part of it.
Exactly.
You got to do something about the demand. And,
right.
And, you know, it's just not working. Just say no, never work.
It did not work. It's not no. I always used to say job security.
Job security, yes, that's true. Like I said, it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun working narcotics.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of all that narcotics being a medical problem, if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, ladies and gentlemen, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon for $7.
Right.
And after
rent it for $1.99.
Yeah, but you're going to want to.
I can't remember.
You're going to want to watch it a couple times because there's some great scenes and some great details, and you're going to want to get that. And when you want to know more, there's more to know because Gary's got his app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then if that's not enough, now Gary has a book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And after you've gotten the paperback, you're going to want to get the Kindle version because it actually has hyperlinks to the audio from the words of the mouth from Let me try that again. It actually has the audio from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Say goodnight, Renee.
Goodnight, Gary.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.